This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The theme of the work today, follow the money for Google profits and also for politicians coming out of Iowa. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the first day of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Profit reports come and they go. Companies make money or they don't make money. But not all companies are created equal. It's not fair. It's just the way it is. So today's earnings announcement from Alphabet, the holding company for Google, reporting how it's performed in the fourth quarter of 2015 is a big deal. Not so much how much money it made, because net-net, Google reliably reports making truckloads of money quarter upon quarter. But thanks to the company's reorganization not too long ago into Alphabet and its subsidiaries, we've gotten a peek at how some of that company's more, I don't know, shall we say, interesting divisions are performing. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here with more. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So first of all, it's great to have this transparency, right, into what Google/Alphabet is really doing. But it is complicated, I guess you could say. Break down what they did for me, would you?
It is both complicated and less transparent, I think, than a lot of people would hope. It is so complicated, I should say, that Alphabet actually put out an investor guide to its own earnings and how they would be reported, which actually does make sense. What they want to do is clarify what's going to be lumped into Google, which is, you know, basically YouTube and AdWords and Android and Chrome, and what's going to be lumped into these other bets. And so we know now how much those other bets made and how much money they lost, but we don't get this line-by-line breakdown of how much the self-driving cars cost, which is a little bit disappointing.
So let's break it down here just a little bit. Other bets, which is, as you said, you know, curing cancer and self-driving cars and all that stuff. Other bets lost $3.6 billion. They are getting quite the subsidy from search. It's a lot of money to be shoveling around.
It is a lot of money, and other bets, we should point out, made just $448 million. So it's barely a blip. They are spending a ton of money on these, but it's fair to point out that not just search, but ads, just the advertising business, is still 99% of Google's revenue. Now, investors are very happy to tolerate spending $3.6 billion, losing that kind of money on things like self-driving cars and fiber and extending human life, as long as advertising is still performing. So they're going to keep a hawk eye on any potential weakness. But, you know, what Google is basically doing is incubating a lot of other potential businesses, and it's got a lot of money to spend.
Well, let me get you there then, because Google is now basically a giant, or Alphabet, sorry, is a giant holding company, right? And tomorrow morning when the opening bell rings, they will be the most powerful, valuable publicly traded company in the world. Where do they go from here? Are they just betting on another, like, Google-ish kind of thing coming out of these other bets? Is that the deal?
Yeah, they absolutely are. They're hoping that one of these things is going to hit, whether it's the, you know, it's really interesting because last week we talked about Apple trying to diversify. Google's trying to diversify. They're spending a ton of money trying to diversify, and they're hoping that one of these things will be the next Google. But it's still very telling that at the end of the day, the hardest thing to topple is simple advertising.
Right. Just real quick. So what we have now is this ginormous company getting bigger, trying to find other ways to make more money, right? And it's not just Google, it's Apple, it's Facebook, it's all these big tech companies trying to do this.
Yeah, everybody is sort of trying, you know, and that is the mantra of Wall Street. You got to grow or die. Right. And so they're all looking for ways to grow. And then I think Larry Page would tell you that on the side, he wouldn't mind saving the world.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Thanks a bunch, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. The big political story today, of course, is the Iowa caucuses. The big political story of tomorrow comes to us via the political money story of today. The latest campaign fundraising numbers filed on deadline by the campaigns last night. The numbers are about what you'd expect if you've been following things so far. Clinton and Sanders leading on the Democratic side, Rubio and Cruz for the Republicans, Donald Trump mostly using his own cash. About which cash, that is, this item from Marketplace's Kimberly Adams about how much cash the campaigns have on hand and what that can tell us about what those candidates might be able to do after tonight.
How much cash to keep on hand is a tricky balancing act for campaigns. David Primo is a scholar at the Mercatus Center and a professor at the University of Rochester.
It's a bit like saving for retirement, right? You don't know exactly when you should be spending money. You don't know exactly how much you need to save. There's a lot of uncertainty involved.
Spend too much of your cash on one race, and then you might win, but not have enough to keep going. But spend too little, and Primo gets worried.
My sense is that a candidate doesn't want to hold back on spending if it could lead them to a defeat that's going to change the tide of the campaign.
In other words, if a campaign's cash is getting low, they had better win soon. Robert Boatwright teaches political science at Clark University.
Candidates with the cash and with the expectation that they're going to stick around can use that money to plan ahead.
For example, using the money to ramp up their campaign in the next primary state. But there are quite a few candidates in this field who have very little cash on hand, very low poll numbers, but a whole lot of hope.
I think the numbers give us a snapshot about who's doing well, but it doesn't necessarily give us a snapshot about who is going to do well.
John Hudak is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
And I think the reality come Tuesday morning is going to be pretty clear for at least three or four candidates.
But as any presidential candidate and Tupac Shakur know, reality is wrong. Dreams are for real. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Iowa and Tupac, how about that? The first trading day of February was pretty much a wash. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, changing gears here for a minute. After the Civil War, freed slaves settled in an area of Savannah, Georgia, known as Frogtown. Got its name from the frogs that came out in the neighborhood after it rained, and it eventually became a thriving black business district. But in the early 1960s, the state condemned the area, and the federal government built an interstate highway overpass where those black-owned businesses had once stood. Now, though, Georgia Public Broadcasting's Gabrielle Ware reports that some of the residents are making it their mission to tear that overpass down.
Three women in their 70s and 80s load into a white SUV to take a trip to the place they grew up. Lifetime Savannah resident Leona Lang maneuvers her cane into the back seat.
Daddy?
Yeah. So I get this leg up.
Pull it up, sister.
She may not be as agile as she once was, but Lang remembers the streets she used to call home. Martin Luther King Boulevard, formerly known as West Broad Street, is their first destination. You wouldn't be able to tell it now, but it used to be booming.
UMAX store, you had Parker's grocery store, you had Willie Chin Laundry, you had Mr. Cracklin that had a store.
Now an overpass towers over what used to be several city blocks. It exits in the middle of a street line with vacant lots and fast food restaurants. Again, Leona Lang.
Houses were long here. I once lived in a house that was right here. They've been in some more villas or something down here.
Yeah, they coming up. They're building another condo.
That's Justine Winford chiming in. She remembers the closeness of the old neighborhood.
Everybody was your mother. Everybody. We didn't have a telephone, but Mama know what I did on the hill before I got down in the bottom. And I never figured out how she knew, but she did.
You can hear her longtime friend Essie Williams laughing at her story in the background. Many Asian and Jewish immigrants also own stores in the area. In fact, one of the oldest Jewish cemeteries is tucked away off the main road within Frogtown limits. Even though it dates back to the 1700s, the secluded site draws few visitors. Today, wealthier areas just adjacent to Frogtown are flourishing. The streets in the historic district of Savannah boast beautifully renovated older homes and walkable parks and squares. Ellen Harris is with the Savannah Metropolitan Planning Commission. She describes what happens as you travel further from that district and closer to Frogtown.
starts to feel, abandoned in a sense, and the sidewalks aren't complete. It doesn't. It's very difficult to cross the street. There's no crosswalks, etc.
The commission is working on a project to rebuild the area near I-16. The most likely plan? To remove the overpass and create a new street design that connects to the more affluent areas of the city. Tom Thompson, the Metropolitan Planning Commission's executive director, says they're in a critical planning stage.
If the feds don't agree to change this axis the way we're proposing, then the project could be dead at that point.
Though some were skeptical at the start, the commissioners have done well in garnering public support to remove the overpass. But Leona Lang and her friends say the change won't bring back the thriving Black community they remember.
There is no way they can rejuvenate West Broad Street. Because West Broad Street had houses and they had a lot of Black businesses on both sides of the street. Right. It's not going to benefit not even the descendants that were down there.
Because they're already gone?
Majority of them are already gone.
Ellen Harris says she doesn't know if any of the old businesses will ever come back to Frogtown. Most were forced to close their doors when I-16 went up. Now, planners are waiting to see if they can tear that structure down. In Savannah, I'm Gabrielle Ware for Marketplace.
A word now about the business of business schools. Over the weekend, Cornell University said it's going to combine its three business-focused schools into one big giant college of business. MBAs are now going to be under the same umbrella as hotel administration students, management undergrads, and accounting majors. It's a reminder that the professors who teach future business leaders about the rapidly changing business environment are dealing with a whole bunch of changes of their own. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York.
Cornell's leadership is saying the kind of stuff business faculty members teach new MBAs in strategy class, talking competitive advantage, scaling up, and trying to offer something nobody else can.
The hope out here is to create a college of business that is unique.
That's Sumitra Dutta, who will be its dean. Now he's got to apply business theory to the very untheoretical challenge he faces.
In some sense, what is happening in the business school segment is not too different from what you see happening in other industry segments like, let's say, accounting or consulting.
The very top business schools, Harvard, Stanford, and the rest, keep getting stronger. Cornell wants into the top 10. It thinks it can do that by getting bigger and marshaling its advantages, like its highly regarded hospitality management program. Rafiq Dasani is at RAND.
Cornell, I think, is doing the right thing, but it's not going to be easy to jump into the top that way.
This comes as some mid-tier schools change their focus entirely, even get out of the business of full-time MBAs to focus on lucrative executive MBA programs. Matt Simmons of the admissions consulting firm Fortuna says many students are questioning the traditional MBA because of its double price tag.
The eye-watering tuition of business school and the opportunity cost of giving up 2 years in the early years of your professional career.
Those students are choosing to get their MBAs part-time while they work, and colleges are jumping to serve them. Cornell plays in that field as well, but this latest move shows it wants to level up in the fierce battleground for full-time MBAs at the same time. How it fares may someday be a good case study for future business students. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So for about 75 to 80% of households in the U.S., when the water goes down, it goes through a really vast network of pipes.
Come on, you know you've always wondered, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 17 points today. 10% closed at 16,449. It was ugly right after the bell. Finished pretty much flat, though. The NASDAQ up 6 points at 10%, 4620. S&P 500, as I said, 19 and 39, basically flat. Falling oil and gas prices weighed on energy stocks. Southwestern Energy off 4.3%. Chesapeake Energy sputtered 5.3% lower. Chipotle Mexican Grill spiced up 4.3% on reports that the federal regulators are ready to declare the restaurant chain's E. coli outbreak officially over. Abbott Laboratories advanced 1.5%. The healthcare firm announced plans to buy diagnostic test company Alere for 5.8 billion simoleons. Alere, as often happens, up 45% on the news. Bond prices down. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Not that we need more bad news about Flint, Michigan, but Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency, weighed in today. It's possible, they said, that the eventual costs of fixing the pipes in Flint, as well as follow-on social services and legal settlements, could undo the progress that Michigan has made in repairing its budget. That's worth keeping in mind when you consider the lead problem in America doesn't stop at Flint's city limits. David Rosner is a professor of the history and ethics of public health at Columbia University. He is also, more to the point, the author of a book called Lead Wars. Professor, it's good to have you on the show.
Nice to be here.
You have called lead, in your writings, the longest-running childhood epidemic in history. That is amazing.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is amazing and troubling.
And in Flint's case in particular, it has distinct and very clear economic and industrial roots, right?
Right. In the entire country, it has deep industrial roots. It really became a problem with the arrival of the U.S. as a major industrial power in the beginning of the 20th century and has continued to this day.
Why is that? Is lead especially valuable industrially?
Well, lead has many uses, some of them abuses, I should say, but It's been put into paint. It's been used as a solder, of course. It's been used on all sorts of industrial products. So it's basically a product that was useful throughout the 20th century and unfortunately was understood to be a major industrial problem both in the 19th and early 20th century for industrial workers, and then was identified as a childhood poison, a poison that literally caused neurological damage among children really beginning in the 19-teens and 1920s in this country.
Have there been efforts to get industry to pay to ameliorate this problem? And if so, how's that gone?
Yes, I think right in California, right next door to you, there's a major lawsuit that's now wending its way through the appeals court in which the cities of San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, Oakland, and a couple of other towns, major cities in the state, have sued the lead pigment manufacturers for having sold them a known neurotoxin, a known material that could cause trouble for children. And that suit resulted in a verdict of a fine for $1.15 billion. That's now being appealed in your appeals court and in your Supreme Court.
But $1.1 billion gets you almost nowhere in this, right? It has to be a trillion-dollar infrastructure problem.
That's absolutely right. There was an earlier suit that went forward in Rhode Island that ended up in a $4 billion verdict, but was overturned by the state Supreme Court in Rhode Island. This is just really, in some sense, the beginning of what might be a tip of the iceberg, and I think that's what's driving everyone nuts because this has terrible implications for cities and cities around the country and for major industries who are going to be held accountable.
It's in houses across this country, privately owned homes. It's in, car batteries, as you said. I mean, it's in so many places. It's not possible for us to be completely free of lead.
Well, maybe not completely free, but certainly in the places that it's most dangerous. Certainly right now, the walls of the nation are the most serious hazard for housing that was built between really 1920 and 1970 or so. All those walls probably have lead. If we identified houses that where children were living or where young couples were moving in planning to have kids, we probably could handle it fairly systematically. But the problem is that there are enormous costs, and we have to make decisions about whether the cost, financial cost, is worth the cost to our children's lives.
David Rosner is the author of a book on the topic at hand. It's called Lead Wars. He is also a professor of public health and the history of public health at Columbia University. David, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
There's a neighborhood way up in the San Fernando Valley, about 30 miles north-northwest downtown L.A., that's been dealing with a massive natural gas leak for the past 3 months. It's called Porter Ranch. This leak is so big that the State Air Resources Board says it figures California's methane gas emissions have increased by 25% because of it. Thousands of people have been forced from their homes. Schools and businesses have been shut down. People are reporting headaches and nausea and nosebleeds. So we went up there the other day and started talking to people.
It's pretty strong. Some days better than others. The cloud at night is really bad, too. I'm concerned, you know, like they're offering you to relocate you, maybe, or to clean your air conduct, but that's going to be enough for all of us. What are we going to do?
I'm an avid hiker, and I hike Lime Canyon Trail, so I knew that the gas company was back there, and I started smelling it, like, throughout my pregnancy. And my husband's like, no, it's not. And I was like, no, every time I'm on the 118 freeway, like, I smell it. It just smells like you left the gas on, but it's a really, really, like, strong odor. I have a lot of concerns.
My husband's, like, having respiratory, like, breathing problem lately. And in the morning when we get out to bring the kids to school, you can really smell. Because before the sunrise, the blowing of the air, I think, is down, so you can smell it.
The homes up here are beautiful, and now the property value has gone down. So many people have moved away.
It's affecting us and also our animals and plants. We've just been coping with it so far and stuff like that, but I think it's about time, you know, that we do get out of here for a bit. Now we're down here trying to get relocated and stuff.
Kids do understand what is going on. They're tired of headaches. They're tired of stomach aches. They want their air back.
In Porter Ranch, California, that was Alessandra Espinoza, Gina Batista, Robert Concheron, Gabriel Conleon, Jennifer Grooms, and Maria Milanes. It's been raining out here in California a bunch this winter. El Nino is being very good to us, but we're still technically in a drought, and there are water shortages going on all over the world. No matter what you blame them on, global warming or just weather, drought has people thinking more and more about our water and how we use it, people including this guy.
Hi, this is Mike from San Francisco, and I've always wondered what happens to our water after we use it.
So Mike's question led us to today's installment of our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Marketplace's Andy Euler is on this one.
Now, it's something you do every day. So after you flush, wash your hands, what happens next? I asked David Kaiser, because he's an environmental economist at Iowa State.
So for about 75 to 80% of households in the U.S., when the water goes down, it goes through a really vast network of pipes where it makes its way to a wastewater treatment facility where it's then treated before discharged into a local waterway.
If you're in Los Angeles, that network of pipes is almost 7,000 miles long, and there's a good chance that your wastewater ends up at Hyperion Wastewater Treatment Plant. On an average day, the plant treats nearly 300 million gallons of water. Some of that gets recycled, but most ends up in the Santa Monica Bay. I met Tim DeFerra, the plant manager out there, for an explanation of exactly what goes down at the plant. He says much of that process is running water through a series of screens and filters.
And so we allow all the solids to settle on the bottom and the floatable stuff to flow on top. And so we skim those floatable stuff, and we take the solids from the bottom of those tanks and send them to our digesters ready for that process.
The remaining water gets pumped with a bunch of oxygen to break it down. After that, it goes to the most visible part of the plant, 36 circular pools that house the water in the final stage of the treatment process. And those birds that like to hang out in the pool most days? DeFerra says they're there because they know the water's clean. But those pools are only a fraction of the plant's infrastructure. Most of it is underground. James Mihelsik teaches civil engineering at the University of South Florida in Tampa.
There's almost 150,000 manholes, and there's close to 50 pumping stations. You know, so most of the underground infrastructure that serves that plant is quite extensive, and, you know, most community members wouldn't even know it existed.
but it's those thousands of miles of sewers that everyone in Los Angeles is telling you to try and use less of. Remember, there's a drought out here. And as Los Angelinos flush less, the irony is that it's making Tim DeFerra's job at Hyperion harder.
The volume comes down, but the concentration of the materials in that water doesn't reduce. So now you have a higher concentration of solids. It becomes a challenge, but that's a challenge that we are up to and we are geared to handle.
Because it's not like the water can go untreated. The Department of Water and Power fell short of its budget, partly because residents reduced water consumption by almost 10% more than expected. So the commissioners approved a rate hike. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
If you've got a question, something you've always wondered about, you can ask us on our website, marketplace.org. Maybe we'll get you on the air. This final note on the way out today, in which Bill Gates reveals himself to be just a little bit creepier, maybe controlling than we might have thought he was. Gates did an interview with the BBC over the weekend in which, among other tidbits, he said that back in the early days at Microsoft, he memorized employees' license plates so he could keep track of when people were coming and going. Fine, I guess, startup pressures and all that, but he didn't want to just memorize, you know, people and faces because he worked with them, you know? All right, we got to go. The Dow off 17 points today, a 10th percent. The Nasdaq gained 6 points, also a 10th percent. S&P 500, basically flat. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're back tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.